Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Welcome to Intergenerational Politics with Jill Winebanks and Victor Shi, where we host weekly political discussions that are engaging and relevant to all generations. As always, we want to thank you for listening to Intergenerational Politics. If you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts to support future episodes. And we also have a website, intergenerationalpolitics.com. This is Victor. I am the co-host of this podcast, an incoming freshman at UCLA next year, and also elected as a delegate for Biden, Illinois.
And I'm Jill Winebanks, the author of The Watergate Girl, based on my experience during the Watergate trial as the only woman on the team. I also had the privilege of serving in the Carter administration in the Pentagon as General Counsel of the Army, and also as Deputy Attorney General of the state of Illinois. So with that, Victor, want to introduce our guest?
For sure. So we come to you today, you know, days after it was officially announced that Joe Biden would be the president-elect and Kamala Harris the vice-president-elect. Moments after it was announced, we saw hundreds, thousands of people in the streets celebrating, in part because of joy over Vice President Biden and Senator Harris winning, but also in part of joy because of we're free from the chaos and the damage that has been inflicted to our most basic values as a nation caused by the Trump administration. Today, we couldn't be more honored and grateful to be talking to U.S. Congressman and Majority Whip in the House, Jim Clyburn, about his support for Joe Biden during the primaries, his thoughts on the Joe Biden's campaign, the transition, and what he expects under the next administration. So first, thank you so much for being here, Congressman Clyburn. It is a real honor.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be with you.
Thank you. And the first thing I want to talk about is for early supporters of Vice President Biden during the primary, there were some moments of concern. There were some very bad moments where, for example, on the night of the Iowa caucuses, where Joe finished fifth, and he was continuing to struggle in New Hampshire and Nevada. But then you became a hero. You changed everything. You gave a speech in South Carolina in which you very powerfully said, "I know Joe, we know Joe, and Joe knows us." It made a real big difference. So let's start by talking about, first of all, you've known Joe Biden, president-elect, for a long time. You knew him in Congress, and you also knew him while he was vice president. So can you just talk about him as a person, as a colleague, and as maybe as a negotiator who might be able to cross party lines?
Well, you know, first of all, Joe's background and experiences are really pretty close to my own. And the way I really got to know Joe was doing these kinds of events with him. We used to be on Todd Rose's show together a lot. And it was because we sort of had views on Brown v. Board of Education that came from our personal experiences. Mm. Now, a lot of people know Brown as being a Kansas case because that's what the name was. But the Brown case originated here in South Carolina.
Really?
It was Briggs v. Elliott at the lower court. And then there was a case up in Virginia, the Davis case in Virginia, Bolton in Washington, D.C. And then there was a case, two cases coming out of Delaware, Belton v. Gebhardt. And Joe and I used to talk about what those cases meant and how we had a different set of experiences trying to negotiate through all of that. And I spent time on the board of the Southern Regional Council, which was a biracial group of people that came together trying to implement Brown. So these things just form the foundation of our relationship. So, but on that day that I made the endorsement, what was going through my mind was the long discussions I'd had with my wife. My wife had passed away about 6 months earlier. She loved Joe Biden. And she talked to me all the time about doing what I could to help Joe Biden get elected. And it was one of the last discussions we had was about Joe Biden. And then it turned out on that Friday before the South Carolina debate, I went to a funeral, and there on the front pew of the church was a lady who I'd never seen before, who beckoned me over to her. And I went over. She said to me, "I need to ask you a question. And if you don't want anybody to hear the answer, lean down and whisper it in my ear." And I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "I need to know who you're voting for in this election." And I leaned down and complimented her, and I whispered in her ear, "I'm going to vote for Joe Biden." And she said, she snapped back, and the look in her face, I can't explain it. But it was just the way she looked when she said to me, "I needed to hear that. And this community needs to hear from you." And that, I said, "Well, I need to do something." But that's why I made the endorsement when I did and the way I did it, because she was right. The community was waiting to hear from me. I felt that. I never knew the impact of the endorsement, though I was hopeful that we could do it in such a way that would help out on a Super Tuesday. Now, what I meant when I said that Joe knows us, Joe suffered a catastrophic event at the age of 29, just after getting elected. Wife and daughter getting killed in an automobile accident, two sons laying up in the hospital before he was ever sworn in, before he was even old enough to be sworn in. Had two aneurysms that he overcame, another son to pass away, stuttering in his childhood, spending his whole life trying to overcome stuttering. These are kinds of things that if people knew them, Joe just internalized so much of what a lot of people that I represent have been through. So to me, it was kind of easy to endorse him. So all this talk about I was thinking about doing something else, none of that's true. I was never going to vote for anybody but Joe Biden.
I love that story, and I love that there were two prominent women in your life who influenced that. And so that's okay. So now that you had this impact, which completely reversed his fortunes in the primaries, can you tell us, you know, at that time, it wasn't sure that what was going to happen, but in terms of policy, what were you supporting when you supported him, when you said you were going to vote for him? Was it just character, which is high integrity and real empathy, or were there some policies that you felt he was the right one, or strategies that he had?
Well, strategy, yes. Policy, I had no problem with him on policy. But I was having a problem with him on strategy. So the Sunday night before the debate, we met with him and Bennett Thompson and Marsha Fudge, Bennett Thompson from Mississippi, Marsha Fudge, Congresswoman from Ohio, and his sister. And there was some, I think Donald Payne was in the room. Cedric Richmond was delayed. He was supposed to be meeting with us. But at that meeting, I said to him that I'm going to endorse. Here's the way I'm going to do it. But I need some help from you. And I said to him that at this debate, please answer every question the way my father, the fundamentalist minister, would answer it in threes. Here is what this answer means to you. Here's what it means to your family. here's what it means to your community, and stop talking. I told him that I just thought that he was talking too much, which is great on the floor of the Senate, but not so good in debates and trying to make points with public. So that's really all I said to him. Now, I did tell him that I thought that one of the undercurrents in the Black community was that there had been four women appointed to the Supreme Court, and never had a Black woman been given serious consideration. And I thought that's something he ought to think about.
And obviously he's taken your advice, which was very smart.
Right. For sure. And you know, all of this is bringing me back memories of Iowa. Jill mentioned the Iowa caucus, and so I went to the Iowa caucus to help out with the Get Out to Vote operations there. And my school, some of our AP government classes went there, and I met up with them on that Monday, which was the Iowa caucus. And we had the option of either going to Pete Buttigieg's rally or Joe Biden's rally. And I was the only one out of a group of like 45 people, I think, to go to Joe Biden's rally. The spirits were so low. And then, you know, afterwards, I made my way to Pete Buttigieg's rally, and it was just, the spirits were so high there. It was just the opposite. But, you know, that moment that you, that speech that you gave really changed everything. I'm just wondering, like, did you expect that you'd be the one to, I guess, revive Joe Biden's campaign?
Well, I thought that I could help him do well in South Carolina, but I had no idea that it would work out the way it did. Though I made plans for that. What I did, and I told him, this was Sunday night when I met with him, all day Monday. You may know Antoine C. Wright, who does a lot of my stuff, my media stuff. I got Antoine, and we sat down and did two or three robocalls. We did about three radio ads, basically for Black radio stations. Mm-hmm. And I said to Antoine, now you put these in the can. We're going to make this endorsement 9 o'clock. Wednesday morning, and let's flood the zone. And if things go well on the 29th, which is that Saturday, then let's be prepared to move into North Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, with these ads and these robocalls. And that's what we did. We got the results Saturday night. A 29-point victory. And I got up the next morning and went straight to North Carolina. I went up to Fayetteville and Goldsboro. And people were talking. And they were, all they were talking about was that Wednesday morning endorsement. And so I called Antoine back. I said, Antoine, it is working. Get to work. And that's, the rest is history.
Right, for sure. And you know, since that moment, a lot has happened in both the primary and general elections. But through all of the noise and criticism of the campaign, one thing that really struck to me, you know, being on the campaign and helping out, was just how focused the campaign was on sticking to its message and core values and really ignoring some of the outside pressure and criticism. And you know, now as we see that strategy worked, and with voter turnouts far surpassing what we saw in 2016, I guess I would be curious to know, you know, when you compare this election with past elections and past campaigns, you know, there's so much about past campaigns. You know, this is the most important election in our lifetime. You know, it's always about, you know, reuniting people. What stood out to you the most about this election? Why was that different compared to past ones?
Well, you know, I think that what was easy, and this may sound strange to you, but if you were to take Barack Obama out of the equation, look at the backgrounds, look at who the white Democrats were for president, the Democratic candidates. Go back through time, and what you're going to find is Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, Lyndon Johnson, and now Joe Biden. They all got one thing in common. They're Southerners. Mm-hmm. They're Southerners. And what I have found is that if you can relate to the constituents in such a way that they feel you, not just hear you, but to feel you. And I think that these candidates, because of their backgrounds, their experiences, they can develop that the empathy that you get from the kind of experiences that you've had. Look, I don't know that there was anybody could have gotten the Great Society programs through the Congress the way Lyndon Johnson did. No president had put more African Americans on judiciary than Jimmy Carter did. No president has brought African Americans into the administration the way Bill Clinton did. And even if you go all the way back to Harry Truman, he was from Missouri, and so you get, and it was Harry Truman because of an incident that happened with an African-American soldier here in South Carolina. He moved to integrate the armed service. He filed his executive order because of that incident right here. Now you have Franklin Roosevelt that gets a lot of credit for a lot of things, and he did save the economy with the New Deal and all of that, but he refused to integrate the armed services. And he was begged to do so by civil rights groups. He refused to allow Blacks in the South to participate in the Work Products Administration, the CCC. All these jobs had white only on them. He was a great New Yorker, but he didn't have the kind of empathy. So I've studied this stuff a lot, and I think that what you have to do is figure out a way to make the connection so that people can not just hear you, but feel you. And that, to me, is what Joe does. I've had some people to criticize earlier, but he gave his acceptance speech that night. He says, to the African-American community, you've always had my back, and I will have your back. I'm not too sure that anybody else would have said that.
He has the extraordinary empathy that very few people have. And I knew Hillary Clinton personally and knew her to also have great humanity, aside from her intellect that everyone recognized.
Sure.
But her empathy and her generosity and her humor never came across. And
never
so
did.
You've made a very interesting point about how Southerners have had a better shot at doing that. But okay, so let's go to a slightly different subject, which is one of my biggest concerns and biggest reliefs when I heard that we had President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris, is that we will return to the rule of science and the rule of law. And I've been very concerned, particularly about the Department of Justice, which I served and loved for a long time. I used to be very proud to go to court and say, on behalf of the people of the United States. And we've lost that, I think. So I'm really focused now on what should President Biden, when he is sworn in, consider in nominating an attorney general? Should it be someone who's totally nonpartisan? After the impeachment and the resignation of Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford appointed Edward Levy, who was University of Chicago Law School dean, and he was completely nonpartisan, and that helped to restore respect to the Department of Justice. And I think we need that now. So I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions for him on who your favorites are for Attorney General and how to restore the reputation of the department.
Well, I don't know if I'll get into names with him, but I will tell him the kind of person I am. You know, I think that one of the things that we have to keep in mind, it's one thing to be partisan, it's something else, again, to be political. And you don't have to be non-political to be non-partisan. I think that we have to keep in mind that the political process needs the experience of that you learn from politics to make it work. I think that Janet Reno was very nonpartisan, much to Bill Clinton's chagrin. But she was political. There's no question about that. Carrie Meeks knew Janet Reno real well. And Carrie and I were very good friends. I still are good friend. She's no longer in the Congress, but and we used to talk about Janet all the time, political but very nonpartisan. So I think he needs to get someone who understands the political process and can be political, but still be nonpartisan. So I would not get into any real names, but I know of quite a few people who would fit that bill.
Excellent. I'm pushing for some of my sisters-in-law at MSNBC, who I think would be great attorneys general.
I think I know who some of those are.
I'm sure you do. And they're terrific people. So.
And I'll tell you something else. You know, I keep hearing Sally Yates' name floating around. Yeah. And she, and when I talk about Jimmy Carter and the African-Americans that he put in the judiciary, in various judgeships and all that kind of stuff. You remember who his attorney general was? He was also a Southerner.
Yes, he was. He was. And Sally Yates is an excellent example of someone who would be, I think, ideal. Barbara McQuaid and Joyce Vance. Barbara McQuaid is actually on the transition team for the Department of Justice. And so I want to talk a little bit about transition because it has been held up because the president, current president, will not concede, and the GSA will not ascertain or confirm that the new president-elect is Joe Biden. And so there are serious things that are being stopped, like security clearances for his top staff, briefings that some would be even secret materials that can't be shared because they don't have the security clearances. So there's some real problems with the transition. I don't think people understand the importance of transition, things that happen during this period that foreign nations may take advantage of. As the beneficiary of the transition in the Carter administration, I saw the work of the transition team because I was nominated for three jobs in three different agencies. And in reading the transition reports, you learn a lot about, you know, when you get to your desk at the new place, what would you actually be doing? And that's really important. But I think the most important right now is whether this refusal to concede is stopping, for example, the credibility of the election results and will be believed by some. So tell me what you think about how transitions should work and how we could bring about a change so that transition can officially start for Joe Biden.
Well, I think that Joe has made it very clear that he's moving forward with everything that he can possibly do. And you're right. He doesn't have access to the daily briefings. They're not giving him all of the information they're getting of a security nature. And if you recall, the 9/11 Commission gave some blame for the breakdown that allowed that to occur to the fact that we had a delayed transition. I guess it was in December before the Supreme Court ever declared George W. Bush the winner. And so this kind of stuff needs to take place. However, having said that, I do believe very strongly that this one will come to a close before. He may not ever concede, and I don't think he ever will. The truth of the matter is, he lost the election, and he's never told the truth about anything. So for him not to tell the truth about losing the election, that won't be a surprise to me. But I do believe that something else is at stake here, and not just our security when it comes to foreign powers, but our security internally, our security economically. I do believe that the corporate leadership of this country, aside from the Republican Party, will step into the breach very soon and says, hey, enough is enough. And we got to bring this to a close because a lot of international business interests are at stake and could very well be damaged irreparably if we don't.
Is there any way that Congress could force GSA to officially the word is ascertain, to confirm the victory of Joe Biden and release the funds? Or is that something that you have no power to do?
Yes, Congress got the power to do that, but you got to get it past two houses to do it. And it can't be done unless the outlaws have to be signed by the president. So no, it won't happen.
Oh, God. Well, let's hope that something happens in the next couple of days or weeks that gives us hope from the GSA. But let's transition into some of the work that is ahead of us, because we know it won't be easy. One reason is that we're kind of experiencing some conflicting ideologies within the Democratic Party. As Whip, you know, you've had to wrangle some of the Democratic members and build consensus in your own caucus. But as we head into the next Congress and next administration, what do you think Joe Biden and the next leadership in the White House and also the House of Representatives have to do in order to unite some of these competing viewpoints within the party in order to meet the needs of the American people?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because this is something that I don't quite understand. You see some pictures behind me. Mm-hmm. That's my late wife. We stayed married for 58 years. Mm-hmm. In that 58-year period, we had a lot of differences. We had disagreements. Flowing from her background and my background were totally different. And we had to reconcile those differences. Mm-hmm. And you've got a caucus like the Democratic caucus, where we got 55 African-Americans in our caucus. They've got one African-American in the Republican conference. And we've got people in our caucus from all walks of life, all kinds of experiences. We are not as vanilla, nor as we uniformed as the Republican conference. And so there are going to be differences in our caucus, mm-hmm. and we have to recognize that. However, I maintain, and I've said this, I did an op-ed for the Washington Post several years ago when we were trying to do that super committee stuff, trying to get to a budget. And I said in my op-ed piece, if the distance between me and opponent on any political issue require five steps, I don't mind taking three of them. You know, and to me, compromise is what you do in order to further any agenda. And I don't know why we have to feel that it's got to be my way or no way. I said to someone earlier today, I never tell anybody that they're wrong. You never know. You can beg to differ. I've got a different opinion than you have, but I cannot say that you're wrong. Only the passage of time and circumstances can make the determination as who's right and who's wrong. Mm-hmm. How many people told me that I was wrong? I mean, to the point of being angry with me for endorsing Joe Biden. Now, everywhere I look, people are saying, it turns out this is the only guy who could have won on the Democratic side. No other of those 20-some-odd candidates would have been able to be successful looking on how it came out. Mm-hmm. Well, I took all that into consideration. I talked about whether or not, and I used the word, I really believe that Joe Biden would be Teflon to these attacks that knocked off all those people that opposed this president 4 years ago. And so you never know. You do what you think is in the best interest, and you hope you come out right. But now I'm hearing people saying, you know, well, you're just wrong about that. Nobody is just wrong about anything. You never know about that until history looks back on it. How many people criticized Harry Truman as being how wrong he was for even integrating the armed services? Strom Thurmond left the party and formed the States' Rights Party and ran for president against Harry Truman because he integrated armed services. Who will say today that that was wrong? But he was accused of being wrong at the time. How many people will say that 1954 Brown v. Board of Education holding was wrong? A lot of people said it was wrong. Billboards went up all over. Get us out of the United Nations. Impeach Earl Warren. You look back on it now, how can you call it wrong? So these are the kinds of things that just really sometimes annoy me. I don't think anybody's got the right to tell anybody that they're wrong. Mm-hmm. Just beg to differ.
Yeah. And I think that's so important after, you know, the last 4 years in which my generation, I think we kind of look at politics, we get a little bit detached because we see all of this kind of fighting between, you know, the president, the Congress, the Senate. And I just hope that under the Biden administration that he can really unite our party and kind of bring us back to a time when we, my generation, can look to our leaders and see that you guys can work together. And I know that you've made it a goal of yours to do that, but, you know, just making sure that all of public officials and elected officials really do go back to that day of compromise and listening to each other rather than attacking each other for their viewpoints.
Well, thank you for that. I'm going to work hard to do that because I really feel that we need the benefit of everybody's experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I was telling somebody the other day, they asked me, said, who won in all of those arguments, disagreements you have with your wife? I said, she won most of the time, but every now and then she would see it my way. But the fact of the matter is, you have to really take these kinds of differences and square them with backgrounds and experiences. If you've got a caucus like ours, and we can't afford to lose all these House seats in the South, we will lose the authority to run the House. And so if we elected every so-called progressive in the North and the West and lose the moderates in the South and the Midwest, what do we have? And the same thing, vice versa. We got to reconcile these differences and just know that they cannot always be in a one way.
I would say if you were married for 58 years that you both won. It wasn't a winner or loser in your situation, but let me ask about another woman, the first female vice president of the United States will be inaugurated on January 20th, something that is exciting many, many women in America. What do you think her role is going to be? How do you think they are dividing up the responsibilities for president and vice president?
I really don't know. Kamala called me on yesterday, and quite frankly, I need to call her back. I have not yet. Whoa. But she did tell me that there's no rush. Just call to catch up, and when you get a chance, let's catch up. So I'll probably get that chance on Friday and call her and catch up. But look, she's a very skilled, highly intelligent woman. Nobody watching her operate on that Judiciary Committee and not know how skilled she is. Her questions were great. She knew how to cut through the issues. She knew how to deliver a line. The closest Joe Biden came to getting derailed in this campaign was because of her questions of him in the debate. So she's a very skillful person. I have no idea exactly what interest she would like to have. But I've already told the Biden team that I have a very significant interest regarding judiciary. And that is the impact of that 1986 and 88 and 94, those three crime bills. All got lumped into the 1994 crime bill, though a lot of what people argued about was spread out over three crime bills. And I think that the priority of the next administration has got to be to look at the unintended consequences from those crime bills. There were good things in the 94 crime bill. The violence against women was in that crime bill. Assault weapons ban was there. Pattern and practice investigations of the of police departments in that crime bill. Drug courts there. Community policing. All that was in the 94 crime bill. But because the crime bill did not get rid of some stuff that was there in 1986, mandatory minimums, it led to this, what we call mass incarcerations. And so we got a lot of people now that's got some records that are keeping them from voting and getting decent employment and for doing what you can do up in Colorado and make a legal living off of. And so I just think, and I've already told them, that's got to be somebody's priority. And maybe a former U.S. attorney, attorney general would be a good person to do that.
One of the other issues you're going to have to deal with is the divided government, possibly, not you particularly, but the administration. The elections and the runoff in Georgia could change that, where the Democrats control the Senate as well as the House. But in the event that there does turn out to be a control by McConnell and the Republicans, what do you think would be the biggest impediment to the administration from Republican control of the Senate? Because I think some of those things may not be understood by the people and might, if they understood the consequences, really motivate Georgia voters to make sure that Joe Biden has the ability to accomplish certain things that he may not be able to do if McConnell is still the speaker, is the leader.
Majority leader.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to say because I do know that there is a different relationship that will exist between McConnell and Joe Biden than that which existed between Barack Obama and McConnell. It will be different. How much different, I don't know. I just got to feel it'll be a significant difference because you tend, when you know people and you've worked with people, you develop a different kind of working relationship. And, you know, it was one thing before Obama was in the Senate, a little more than 2 or 3 weeks before running for president. In fact, I think he was running for president before he got elected to the Senate. These kinds of things conjure up a lot of animus from people who've been there for a long time. So I think their relationship will be different. Now, having said that, I do believe that Biden looked like he's winning by 13,000 to 14,000 votes down in Georgia. So if Joe Biden in the one-on-one race can get to 50%, these candidates in one-on-one can probably get there as well. And so I'm not giving up on winning those seats. Remember, in Warnock, for instance, in that race, there were 27 candidates. 27.
Wow.
So those votes were spread out quite a bit. And they're and were spread out on the other side as well, so nobody got to 50%. Mm-hmm. So I do believe that the chances are, there's a fighting chance that we can win. And what we've got to do is organize it right. Mm-hmm. So I'm not giving up on having the Senate under Democrats' control. I know the odds are steep. But it's been accomplished before.
Like you said, we have to organize and, you know, keep on making phone calls, texting.
Absolutely.
And for sure. So important. I like to end by just kind of asking you to give my generation some hope under our next administration. You know, for the past 4 years, we've had a president who undermines our rule of law, constantly spreads dangerous information, which makes it scary for my generation, and even Jill's generation. What do you think my generation should be hopeful for under this new Biden-Harris administration?
Well, let me tell you, when I saw my schedule had this podcast on, I can't tell you what it did to me. I've got a 25-year-old grandson who's really my neighbor, right across the street he lives from me. And during the campaign, he's very political, loves politics. Mm-hmm. He came to me and told me, he said, Granddad, I think I'm going to get involved in this campaign. And I said, great, son. I'm thinking he was going to be with his granddaddy. He said, I'm going to be working for Pete Buttigieg. And so I said, okay. I says, but just remember one thing for me. I said, I never spanked you when you were growing up, but I'm going to give you a good spanking on election day. And so, but I talked to him last night before, and I would say this to young people. Look. None of this stuff is going to happen overnight in a day. This generational stuff is not all it's cranked up to be. I don't know of anybody in my caucus that's more progressive than I am. I did a one of these Facebook things with Hank Johnson, the congressman from Georgia, earlier today. And I was real amazed, and most of his followers on this thing are young people. And he told me up front, and he closed by saying to them that Jim Clyburn is 80 years old, but I have never, ever seen anybody push more progressive issues harder than he does. And to me, what we have to do is lay foundations upon which young people's futures can be built. Jaime Harrison caught the attention of his entire country in this campaign running for the Senate against Lindsey Graham. Jaime Harrison has been under my wing since he was an 11th grader. He came into my life when he was in the 11th grade.
Wow.
And I worked very closely with him. I tell people, says, where did he come from? I see him here all the time. He was learning. He was putting in the time that's necessary to know how to do this. And he raised about $107 million in South Carolina. And I hope he'll be the next DNC chair. He's 44 years old now. So I would say to young people, same thing I said to my children, get involved. And while you're involved, remember to do one thing for me. Find something to do for which you're not paid. I really believe strongly that the things that pay off for young people more than anything else is when people see them involved in something that is selfless. Everybody expects for you to earn your pay, and you're supposed to earn, do a good day's work for a good day's pay. But when people see that your interests go beyond that which benefits you and you alone, you'll be surprised at how much help you get to get your stuff accomplished.
I hope Victor will take that advice very seriously. Sure. I think it's great advice. And I know someday that I'm going to be very proud that I knew Victor when he was 17 and that he's now president-elect.
That's exactly right.
That's a long journey.
No. I've heard so much. You'll be surprised at how many people know exactly who you are.
Yeah.
You know, they like Jill. They love you.
So thank you so much for being with us. This has been such an illuminating and charming conversation. I really adored it. And I'm so honored that you were willing to talk to us. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I hope you have me back sometimes.
Of course. Thank you. We are definitely. For sure. Yeah. Okay.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Intergenerational Politics. Be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts to support future episodes. Thanks so much. See you in our next episode.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.